really cool things that are happening, and I think it's really important to talk about them. And if you tuned in last year, you might have heard my interview with my guest for this hour, UBC C350. So we have Kate and Max here. Could you take a minute to introduce yourselves and say what you're studying and how you got involved with climate action and whatnot?
In First Nations and Indigenous Studies. I'm a Scottish settler, and I grew up here on the shared territories of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh. And I kind of came into climate organizing when I was in high school, and have continued that into university.
Hey, my name is Max. I'm a third year mathematics student here at UBC. I also grew up on the unceded Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Musqueam territories, known as Vancouver. And I got into 350 in first year. I was looking for a climate activist group, although I didn't do quite as much in high school, and it turned out it was a great community.
That's awesome. Thank you guys so much for coming. I'm really excited to have you. Okay, so before we get going, C350 is a climate action group. And I was just saying to these two before that I personally am in kind of a bubble because I'm a forestry student. And so all of my profs and all of my fellow students and stuff are constantly talking about climate change. And I think it's something that comes up probably 3 or 4 times a day in the spaces that I occupy. But could you give listeners a little bit of a definition of climate change, specifically anthropogenic climate change, and how it's impacting us, and maybe just talk about why it's important to focus on it?
Well, I guess a very basic definition would be change in average global temperature caused by human emissions, and it also comes with more extreme weather events and other changes to weather. But I guess what's really important to focus on is how this affects people around the globe and how it affects some people more than others. And I guess that's what we'll be talking about a bit more later, but I don't know, Kate, if you have anything?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the reason that we need to be paying attention to climate change right now is because we are in the midst of a climate crisis. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is an intergovernmental body of scientists, has said that we have about 10 years to dramatically reduce our emissions and actually transform our entire economy, shift all of our global systems to cut our dependence on the fossil fuel industry and build a world that can withstand the worst effects of climate change. And as we all know from, you know, being in the world and watching the news, the effects of climate change are already here. Australia is burning right now. There are floods in Jakarta that have displaced over 500,000 people. People who were in BC last summer, experienced the smoke that settled over the city. So the climate crisis is here, and it's urgent, and it's critical that we act on it now if we're going to avoid really catastrophic events down the line that will have the greatest burden on the most vulnerable communities among us.
Yeah, I think it's really important to remember that this is an issue that affects everybody around the globe, and it's not isolated to certain parts of the world. It's not just Australia, you know, that is being affected, and it's not just Jakarta. It's everybody in the world. So UBC C350, can you talk about what you guys do? Like, what are your specific goals apart from just, you know, climate action? What are you trying to achieve here on campus and across the city and across the nation?
So C350 is a collective of students, staff, and faculty that organize for climate justice. And I think unpacking what climate justice means and looks like is actually really critical, because the way that we've been taught to think about sustainability issues for a long time has been to imagine that by changing our individual behaviors, we can solve the climate crisis. So we can, you know, stop using plastic straws, and we can eat a little bit less meat, and we can bike more often. And these solutions, these really individual solutions, are things that have been presented to us by our governments, by our corporations, really as a way to detract from the real root causes of the climate crisis, and from and from the real solutions that we need to be taking to mitigate its consequences. So when we talk about climate justice, we're addressing the fact that climate change is, from our perspective, rooted in the joint systems of colonization, of capitalism, and of white supremacy. And we see that showing up in the ways that the impacts of climate change are felt by different communities around the world. You know, it's no surprise that it is Indigenous communities who are always going to be on the front lines of resource extraction and climate impacts. Unist'ot'en Camp, which is a blockade set up by the Wet'suwet'en Nation against Coastal GasLink pipeline and other pipelines in the north of BC, is just one example of that. And so when we're addressing climate change, it means that it's really critical that we're not only addressing the fossil fuel industry and its role in this crisis, but that we're also making sure to center land back for Indigenous people, that we're centering migrants who have been displaced by the climate crisis and opening our borders to them, that we're addressing workers who have been targeted by corporations and left behind in the name of profit. So for us, that looks like thinking about climate change as an issue that is tied into migrant justice and Indigenous rights and justice for workers. So while our main campaign is focused on divestment, on shifting UBC's endowment away from the fossil fuel industry, we also prioritize doing solidarity work with Indigenous communities on and off campus, in standing in solidarity with transit workers, for example, and in doing other work that addresses the ways that all of these systems of power and oppression are interconnected.
That sounded really good, Kate. That was pretty much everything I had to say. But yeah, just to reemphasize, like, what we're doing over here is using the power of collective action to try and create climate justice. And those two terms are really important in our work because that's what we're doing. Like, you might know us about divestment, but that's kind of like a tactic for us to try and make a more climate just future.
That's great. Do you find that that's a hard message to get across? Because here in Vancouver as settlers, I think we are, you know, relatively not unimpacted, but the impact that we see from climate change is a lot less than many Indigenous communities and many communities around the world. So do you find that it's a hard message to get across because we're not seeing the impacts as like intensely and heavily as many communities?
It can definitely be sometimes, I think. The environmental movement as a whole and historically has not always or even mostly been about climate justice. There's a lot of examples of, for example, groups like Sierra Club or Greenpeace doing things that have not really taken into account Indigenous peoples or like how people are marginally or like disproportionately affected by climate change. And a lot of these environmental spaces are not super accessible or safe for people who are queer, disabled, or BIPOC. And that's something that we're looking to change. And it involves both like letting people in who are not involved in activism or in other movements, like communicating with them, as well as like kind of looking inward and critically and examining where our own beliefs and biases might come from, I guess.
And to add on to that, I think one of the failures of the climate movement for the last decade, and I really do think that this is changing, is the fact that for a really long time we thought about climate change and environmental degradation as being issues that were somehow separated from the issues that are affecting all of us in our daily lives. And I think it's really important to remember that the fossil fuel industry knew about climate change in the 30s and actively repressed science and political action that would have addressed the climate crisis and mitigated the effects that we're currently experiencing. And the fossil fuel industry had help in doing this. They were partnered with governments who continued to prioritize corporate interests over the interests of people. And this is manifested in so many ways that extend beyond the ecological impacts of climate change. So we can think about the fact that it's really expensive to access public transit in Vancouver, as a consequence of this alliance between the fossil fuel industry and governments that continue to prioritize corporate interests. We can also think about the housing crisis in Vancouver as being linked to this regime of austerity. And so all of us really do have a stake in the climate crisis, not only when we start to think about forest fires and floods and how we're protecting ourselves against them, but also when it comes to the conditions of our lives right now and questioning why it is that there are multi-billionaires in Canada who have made all of their profits off the fossil fuel industry, while there are also thousands of workers in Alberta who are out of work right now. So making the links between these issues, thinking about how jobs and transport and food and housing all need to be tied into the way that we respond to the climate crisis, I think when we do that, we'll be able to make this issue accessible to a much broader demographic than would be galvanized by, you know, that classic image of the polar bear on a melting iceberg in the Arctic.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that I've found really interesting to witness over the last couple of decades, I know when I was, you know, when I was a kid, you know, environmentalism wasn't, it was kind of just like maybe like a trendy thing that people would sort of subscribe to. But back then it was very much about individual action. It was very much about, you know, reducing the amount of plastic that you're using and consuming, and you know, not eating meat and stuff like that. And now it's absolutely the emphasis has definitely shifted to corporate and governmental action. And I've found that it's kind of two extremes. It went from being all about what you do to being about it doesn't matter what you do. Like, your individual action is kind of like a just kind of a drop in the ocean, and it's sort of insignificant. So how do you feel about, like, of course, as a organization, your emphasis is on corporate and governmental action in terms of climate change and climate action. But do you think that what we do as individuals still matters?
I think it's probably a question that can't really be answered with a simple yes or no, but I guess something to keep in mind is that obviously it does make a difference if someone reduces their lifestyle choices. And what's important to keep in mind, though, is the kind of privilege associated with that, and how like a lot of people don't have that choice to avoid styrofoam, or, you know, don't use plastic straws and stuff when they can't pay their bills, or when they are like have a lot of just situations where it's hard to do that. And rather than, like, it's not like we're telling people, like, you know, do whatever you want, anything, but we're just shifting that emphasis away, and also kind of recognizing that that this emphasis on individual action can be kind of co-opted by like governments and corporations, not to actually like make impact on climate change, but to like just keep people kind of in control and sell products and that kind of stuff, I guess.
And I can also say, from a more personal perspective, when I first became aware of the climate crisis, I was in high school, and I just watched An Inconvenient Truth, and I was just filled with this deep well of despair, where I just felt like there was absolutely nothing I could do, that this crisis was looming in, and that I had no power to do anything about it. Yeah, from this space of desperation, I turned to the only actions I felt were available to me. So that was riding my bike and reducing the amount of meat that I was consuming, and recycling everything that I could recycle, and then yelling at all of my friends and family when they didn't do all those things as well. And the whole time that I was doing these things, I was just filled with this overwhelming sense of my own smallness. I just felt like I was an ant running in circles, and there was a shoe coming down on top of me, and I was doing my best, but it didn't feel like it was landing. And I lived in that space for a really long time until the Enbridge pipeline was proposed. And for folks who don't know, the Enbridge pipeline was a bitumen pipeline that went from the tar sands in Alberta to Kitimat on the north coast of BC. And when I found out about the Enbridge pipeline, all of my recycling and bike riding just felt so inconsequential, because here was this project that would rapidly expand Canada's energy exports and overshadow any efforts to mitigate our climate impacts at home. And so I went to a rally that I saw advertised on a telephone pole, and I came late and I came alone, and I kind of just like stood on the sidewalk and watched the crowd go by, and just you know, like stood on the fringes of this moment until someone put a sign in my hand and pulled me into the crowd. And that was the first time that I felt powerful, because for the first time I felt like I was part of something that was bigger than myself. I felt like I wasn't just one person in a sea of indifference. And that's where our real power comes from, is from when we come together and decide as a community, as a city, as a country, that we're going to do things differently. So I think also from, you know, I think it's effective to organize collectively in a way that individual action is not. But I also think that for anyone who's feeling grief or powerlessness around climate change, the best thing you can possibly do is join a movement, because that's where the real change happens.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of going back to what C350 does specifically. So divestment is a term that I am familiar with, mostly through your work. But for people that don't know what it is, how do you define it? And again, why is it important? And what does that look like on kind of a local and also maybe a global scale?
Well, divestment is basically just not investing in things in particular. And it's been kind of a tactic that's been used in a lot of different movements around the world. Divestment was used against the South African apartheid when major institutions divested from South African companies. Divestment was used against the tobacco industry. It's currently being used against the private prison industry. And it's most majorly being used nowadays is against the fossil fuel industry. And that's kind of the context that we're talking about divestment in that we want UBC, as well as other institutions, to divest their investments in fossil fuels to something else. And usually how they'll look is that, like, universities will have these big endowment funds, and they'll have these endowment funds invested through lots of different mutual funds. And these mutual funds usually have a certain percentage invested in fossil fuels. And that's kind of what all these little divestment movements you see across universities popping up are encouraging universities to do, which is to take all these mutual funds and invest in pools that have no fossil fuels in them. I don't know if Kate wants to say more about that.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that's really powerful about the divestment movement is that it has gained so much momentum in a really short amount of time. 5 years ago, the fossil fuel divestment was just getting started, and now literal billions of dollars all around the world have been divested from the fossil fuel industry. And it's universities, but it's also churches, it's also corporations, really oddly. It's cities like London and New York. It's even countries like Northern Ireland who have all taken this stand against the fossil fuel industry by pulling their funds out of its investments. And I also really want to emphasize that that the fossil fuel divestment movement is an attack on the social license of fossil fuel industries to operate. And this is something that does get muddied a little bit, because institutions like UBC have in the past taken the line that, you know, we're just trying to do what's best for the endowment, and this is a purely financial decision. It's not. It's a challenge to the legitimacy of the fossil fuel industry. And it's a way of saying no more. This industry cannot have a future in Canada. It can't have a future in the world. And we need to be moving against it.
So I think a lot of people might be unaware that institutions like UBC or even like cities like Vancouver would have investments in the fossil fuel industry. So what do those investments actually look like? What sort of investments are they? Because I think a lot of people don't even know that they exist.
So essentially the way that most major institutions work is that they have an endowment or an investment pool that's just spread out through a wide portfolio of companies. That's how investment works. You are probably invested in some fossil fuel companies if you have your money in a major bank like TD or RBC. And when you're a bigger institution, obviously those holdings just are more significant. So UBC has about a $2 billion endowment fund, and we estimate that around 80 million to 100 million of that is invested in the fossil fuel industry. And that's not something that they've actively chosen. They go through an investment manager who just distributes funds wherever the market is good. But because the fossil fuel industry is supported by massive subsidies from governments, it is a favorable place for a lot of investors to put institutional money. So that's kind of the context that we're coming into this with.
Right, absolutely. So we're going to take a quick ad break, but then we'll be back in a few minutes with UBC C350.
In the context of Vancouver's opioid crisis, CITR would like to take a moment to share some harm reduction strategies.
Try not to do drugs alone. When going out, let friends know what drugs you're taking and make sure someone has an naloxone kit. If you're able to, get your drugs tested before taking them.
Avoid mixing opioids with alcohol or stimulants. Remember that opioids can include painkillers prescribed by a doctor, and it's possible for any drugs to be contaminated with opioids.
Learn the signs of opioid overdose, which include, but are not limited to, unresponsiveness or unconsciousness, inability to speak, breathing that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, heartbeat that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, skin tone that has turned blue or gray, choking or gurgling sounds.
If you think someone is overdosing, call 911 immediately. Start rescue breathing and administer naloxone if you have it. You cannot get in trouble for being on drugs, so always call 911 in an emergency.
For more information about naloxone kits and training, visit towardtheheart.com.
Thank you and stay safe.
Discorder magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
You're tuned in to 24 Hours of Student Power here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people here on UBC's Point Grey campus. So we're back with UBC C350. So before the break, we just talked generally about kind of their definitions of climate change and divestment. And they're doing a lot of really amazing work here on campus and in Vancouver. And so I think it's time for us to talk about some of the things that you've done in the last year. Because since we talked, which I guess would have been last November or so, you guys have had some really huge achievements. So can you kind of just talk about some of your major ones? I mean, ones that come to mind are UBC declaring a climate crisis and you kind of spearheading the climate strike on campus. But yeah, if you could just talk about some of your successes over the past year.
Yeah, well, I can start kind of a bit farther back and then Kate can maybe fill in more of this term. But in about February, we had kind of our first major divestment rally and kind of like canvassing event. We had this, our campaign, Break Up with Fossil Fuels, or no, Break Up with Big Oil. And we did a bunch of canvassing and a big campaign. And one thing that's notable is that UBC's position on divestment was really different in February. They were not into it at all, and there was no indication that they would be divesting anytime soon. And that's why we had this big show of canvassing and rallies and support, and we made like a big fossil fuel divestment X in the plaza. And that kind of, and over the summer, you know, things kind of cooled down a bit. We're students. But in this term, we've done a lot of cool things. Our term started off with Climate Strike, which was absolutely huge. We helped organize the UBC Climate Strike, and then walked over to the main one in Vancouver. And I don't remember the number, maybe Kate does, but there were so many people in attendance. And that was quite a big rally, and it was really, really exciting. And I'll pass it over.
Yeah, so we had about 5,000 people who showed up for the UBC climate strike in September. And for me, this is really exciting, and I think it also gestures to the moment that we're in. You know, this is the year when we've seen climate strikes emerging across the world in really unprecedented scales, like literal millions of people, and mainly led by high school students who have been walking out of their schools and their work to take a stand for climate justice. And this is not something that we could have imagined even a year ago. And I think here and all around the world, we're seeing this really radical shift, especially led by young people, especially led by Indigenous people and other communities of color, who are feeling the urgency and who are holding governments and corporations to account. And I just think back to when I was in high school, when the conversation really was about recycling and straws, and how much things have shifted. You know, you have high school students in Vancouver who are calling out corporations and holding die-ins in front of tech offices. So I think the narrative has shifted in a really exciting way, and the UBC climate strike was just one part of that. So yeah, we organized the UBC climate strike here on campus. A massive community of people came together on that day. And I think it's also a really incredible example of what can happen when communities are willing to build relationships and organize across lines of difference. Because for a long time, we've talked about this a little bit, the environmental movement has been very insulated. It's been made up mostly of white folks, and it hasn't really made a very concerted effort to reach communities beyond itself. But with the climate strike, we were able to open it up to literally everyone. We created an open letter calling on UBC to declare a climate emergency, and we had communities all across campus signing on to that and engaging with the moment. So, you know, the UBC Bangladeshi Students Association, a whole series of cultural groups on campus, groups like the Ski and Board Club, the Faculty Association, a whole series of departments that issued statements of solidarity with the climate strike and that encouraged their teachers to cancel classes so that students could participate. It was really a moment when the entire community came together and stood together for climate justice. So that's the energy that we brought into this fall, and I think it did a lot to propel some of the wins that we had with our divestment movement.
Did you find that you were at all surprised? I know for me, going to the climate strike, I think I was expecting to see not like-minded people is the wrong word, but just I was expecting it to be kind of composed mainly of other very like outwardly environmental people, and there was a lot of people there that I didn't expect to see, you know, like businessmen in suits and like families with little babies, and I just kind of thought, even on campus, I was like, oh, it's just going to be, you know, like forestry students and LFS students and people that are involved in these environmental groups, and I found that wasn't the case. Were you surprised by that, or was that what you were expecting?
I was really excited to see it. I don't know if I was surprised, because I think we went into Climate Strike with that intention of reaching beyond the choir and building the relationships that need to exist if we're actually going to build a far-reaching and bold and effective movement for climate justice. I don't think I would have counted the Climate Strike as a success if all those communities didn't show up.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of preaching to the choir if that is the case. So yeah, I know us at CITR, we marched together, and I had some friends that were like, but you're a radio station, but it's like, it's, we're still human beings, and it's still affecting us for sure. So yeah, and so what else have you guys been up to? I know there's a few other really major things besides the climate strike.
This term was huge for divestment. And UBC changed their position quite radically in, I think it was September. They put forward a memo saying they thought divestment was not an effective strategy. On the very same day that the UC system, with a $80 billion endowment, divested from fossil fuels. And this is also an interesting case where they divested from fossil fuels, and they said that is just because of the financial reasons. And that's one of the interesting things about how, because a lot of fossil fuels need to be kept in the ground, we're starting to see a little bit of financial instability in the industry, and people are starting to divest sometimes because of that, which is another interesting topic. But UBC changed their position on that after a lot of pressure, and there was also some changes in the board this semester. But maybe Kate can talk about what we accomplished there.
Yeah, so as folks may or may not know, UBC C350 has been organizing for divestment for a long time. Our campaign started 7 years ago now, and it started with that same kind of relationship building that we brought into the climate strike. So in 2015 and 2016, we organized student and faculty referendums calling for fossil fuel divestment from our university, and both of those passed with overwhelming support. And since then, we've been continuing to put pressure on our Board of Governors. In 2016, they rejected divestment with no process and with no transparency, and replaced it with a 1% Sustainable Futures Fund, which actually, before we challenged them on it, contained companies like Enbridge, like Kinder Morgan, like ExxonMobil, which are all companies that are involved in the extraction and transportation of fossil fuels. So in response to student pressure, they created a 1% Sustainable Futures Fund, which was fully divested. But of course, you know, we're in a university, 1% is still a failing grade. And so we continued to ramp up pressure over the next few years, calling on UBC to make the bold decision to divest its entire endowment. And I think that there are some factors that played into it. UBC really does look to the University of California system as a leader. And so when they divested, that put the pressure on us to get down to work. And there's also been some shifts in the board, so more NDP appointees who are more open to sustainable investing. But I really do think that the most decisive shift came from the fact that we were able to build a movement through the climate strike that sustained us through this term, that showed our administration that we meant business and that we weren't going to rest until UBC divested. So we used the pressure of the climate strike to begin a climate emergency declaration process for the university. In December, the university declared a climate emergency, and we were part of the conversations that made sure that divesting from fossil fuels and beginning a process to figure out what responding to climate emergency looked like at UBC was part of that declaration. We held a series of actions throughout the fall. In November, we showed up to a subcommittee of the board, and we had a pathway that we'd set up, and one side said divest now, and the other said climate criminal, and every board member walking into the room had to decide which path they were going to choose. And so through these actions, through the support of our communities, we were able to exert really strong pressure on the board this term. And in response to that, they actually went from a kind of an alternative to divestment that would have allowed them to save some face to radically shifting their position and actually deciding to divest the Trek Fund, which is the money that comes from UBC's land investments, which is really interesting when we consider that this is stolen land, and what does that mean when we're talking about money that's invested in the fossil fuel industry. But they invested, they voted to divest that 22%, and they voted to move forward with full divestment pending one legal opinion that will be coming out in February. So for us, this is a testament to the power of student organizing and student pressure. It's a really powerful move because UBC is the first major institution in Canada to fully divest its endowment fund, to commit to doing that. And it's the first one to commit to divesting because we're in a climate emergency and because radical action is needed. And they're the first to not hide behind the excuse that this is purely for financial reasons. So this sets a really powerful precedent for other universities in Canada, for other divestment campaigns in Canada. The same day that UBC committed to divest from fossil fuels, McGill rejected their third divestment motion. And earlier that week, UVic did the same. So this is a moment where we get to put other universities to shame and say, if we could do it, why can't you?
Yeah, that's really exciting, and it must be it must feel really good to know that you had such a big part in that. So I know for me as a university student, I feel very kind of detached from the administration, and I can imagine that connecting, you know, with the board and with the kind of higher ups at the university must have been pretty challenging. And you talked about some of the challenges that you had to overcome. But what kind of really stands out in terms of like the major challenges in achieving this, and like why do you think UBC's story was a success, whereas other universities were not? Like, what's the difference here? Why did you achieve this, and while other universities have still been denying the climate emergency?
That's a really good question. I'm not really sure if I can comment on why UBC has done it, but UBC has had a really long and sustained campaign for divestment, but also so have some other universities. But I think it really just comes down to, as Kate said, the movement we've been building since the climate strike and the connections you've made with people outside the environmental movement, as it usually stands as well. And also we've been we've in contact with the board quite a lot this term. And I think a lot of those factors have gone really far in pressuring them to divest. Yeah,
I think for like every student and also us, engaging with the board is a really daunting task, because the university administration actually moves at a glacial pace. Like, they are so complex for no reason. Our team has spent so much time over the last few years like trying to navigate this labyrinth of administration, and trying to avoid getting sucked down bureaucratic rabbit holes. And, you know, that piece is that, you know, working with the people in power, or not working with the people in power, but learning how the people in power function to know how you can have the most impact is important. But also really the public pressure that we were able to build was what forced board members to come into meetings with us. Like that public pressure is what allowed this campaign to succeed.
Another thing that I find really interesting is that it is mostly like youth that are leading this movement. It's students, it's high school students, it's young children, and yet there's still a lot of older people that just don't take young people seriously. Have you found that to be a challenge, just being taken seriously as young people?
Yeah, I feel like this whole campaign has just been one long okay boomer. Like, like working with the, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, like the people in power are usually the over 50 white men. And in order to challenge all of those people who hold literally the authority to decide our futures, which is terrifying to me, we just have to be more powerful than them. And that's something that I think we achieve through people power, because we do have the moral authority in this fight. You know, the high school students who have been organizing climate strikes around the world are putting politicians to shame. And I think that's just what we need to continue to do. We need to continue to challenge this implicit authority that boomers have over our futures and the basic rights and services that we need to be able to survive in an increasingly unstable and uncertain world.
Yeah, I think that puts it pretty much on point. I think one thing that was also pretty difficult sometimes is that a lot of times when we were able to get meetings with board members and people on like adjacent to the board, they wouldn't really do any research about what we were asking them on, and we'd kind of have to do all our own research and bring it in, and then they wouldn't really know maybe sometimes like some of the more basic things about divestment. And we kind of have to, like, go back, like, okay, here's the syllabus, you know. But like,
we literally have a syllabus.
Yeah. We did a teach-in divestment 101. But, yeah, a lot of research parties of us kind of trying to figure out things that really could have been better relegated to a paid professional. But, oh well.
And also, what is more ironic than a bunch of undergrad students having to do all of the research so that an administration can make an informed decision?
Absolutely. So another question I have is... do you work with any of the other climate action groups on campus? I know there's groups like Climate Hub and stuff, or are you guys kind of doing your own thing, or are you working with them actively, or?
Yeah, so UBC C350 does many of its own campaigns, but we also are really interested in building relationships. You know, we saw with Climate Strike that was what allowed us to really build the momentum that we needed. And so we do have a close working relationship with the Social Justice Center, with Climate Hub, with other communities on campus. And for us, the priority is really to build alliances with groups that share our values and who represent communities who are often underrepresented in the environmental movement, in the climate justice movement, and who are disproportionately targeted by the climate crisis and by government austerity. So we've definitely been doing a lot of thinking this year about what strategic relationship building looks like. That's a process that's ongoing. I really do think that relationships are at the heart of this movement, and building relationships, building good relationships, is what's going to allow us to win.
Yeah, awesome. So we're going to take another quick ad break, and then we will be back.
Feels like a vortex, all covered in Gore-Tex. Don't look at your text.
Do you like that? How about that? Mondays, 5 p.m. Deliberate Noise. Nina Panini, special guest Claire. Local, new, hot, upcoming shows, toilets, friendship. Mondays at 5. CITR. Be there. Be there.
One, two,
three. Be there.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities.
They are doing this by developing gender-affirming, client-centered models of service,
ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available,
and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support.
Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for the trans members of our community.
Right, you're back on 24 Hours of Student Power on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people on UBC's Point Grey campus. And we are back having this lovely conversation with UBC C350. So before the break, we talked about some of the big wins that they've had in the last year. They've been super busy, and they've done a lot of really cool things. What are the next, you know, few weeks or few months look like for you guys? What are your short term and long term goals? What are the next steps?
Well, after the big kind of divestment win last fall, we're kind of looking at more movement building and really getting people involved, and also looking at a couple really like timely and important projects are going on. One of those that's really important is Una Stoughton Camp and the Coastal Gasoline Pipeline. For those of you who don't know, Coastal GasLink pipeline is a liquefied LNG pipeline that's been proposed to take natural gas from northern BC to the Kitimat terminal, and it goes through the territory of the Wet'suwet'en Nation, who have not given consent to the pipeline. Unist'ot'en Camp is a reoccupation by the Wet'suwet'en Nation of their land, and it's been kind of in operation since 2010, and it's also on the path of the CGL pipeline. And last year, kind of really close to when we recorded this, was there was a violent raid on Unist'ot'en Camp by the RCMP, where militarized police and helicopters and everything was taken over to the camp, and they took down a checkpoint a couple of kilometers up on a road and arrested people. And right now it's a really important thing for us to focus on, because there's threats of more violence from RCMP and CGL going over there, and we're going to be looking at that as well.
Yeah, and we really consider this to be the next step for our divestment campaign. You know, we're moving our fight from the bottom line of the fossil fuel industry to the front line, and we really do need people to be joining with us and organizing with us and supporting Wet'suwet'en Nation at this really critical moment. Other things to look out for this term, we're going to be continuing to organize against the TMX pipeline, which is another bitumen pipeline that would go from the Alberta tar sands to Burnaby. And so that's a project that we're going to be continuing to organize against. There's another climate strike coming up in April, so keep your eyes peeled for that. And we always have other campaigns and events and discussions going on. So we are always welcome to new people, whatever age or experience level or perspectives that you are bringing into this community, you are so welcome. If you'd like to stay involved, our meetings have been Mondays 5 to 6 in the Resource Center, which is on the second floor of the Nest beside the Hatch Gallery. That may be changing, so just keep an eye on our social media. Our social media is on Instagram, we're UBCC350. On Twitter, we are also UBCC350. And on Facebook, we are also, shockingly, UBCC350. So, be sure to give us a follow and stay in the loop. We're welcome to new humans all the time.
It kind of helps having a bit of a weird name when you want to keep your Twitter handle.
Yeah, totally. And also, just out of curiosity, like who is currently a part of UBCC350? That's kind of a tongue twister. do you find, like, is it mostly is it people who were like previously environmental activists, or do you have like people who are kind of new to it, or you know, what's the composition of your team right now?
Right now it's mostly composed of students, but other than that, it's pretty varied. We have students from a different number of year levels, programs of study. Some people have been pretty involved with the environmental movement before they came to university, like Kate here. Some people haven't at all. Some people have been involved with other movements before joining us. It's pretty varied.
We're also just a really great community. There are dogs at some of our meetings. and we're really invested in building communities of care where people are able to organize while still making sure that they're taking care of themselves, and the relationships within our community really matter. So it's just generally a good time.
That's awesome. So what else would you say is kind of important for, besides joining these movements, what's important for people to do in their day-to-day life, just in, you know, kind of in the shadow of the climate crisis? What should people be doing?
I mean, I'm biased because I really hope you join a movement. If it's something that you have capacity for that feels safe and comfortable for you, look for the communities that are doing important work near you. If that's not UBCC350 or the Social Justice Center or other communities on campus, there are so many rad and radical collectives doing incredible organizing across Vancouver. And I really do think like getting involved with a movement is the best thing that you can do. But also, do the work of educating yourself around these issues. Follow Indigenous frontline land defenders on social media and pay attention to what they're saying. Make sure that you're listening to people who are on the front lines of the climate crisis, whose voices really need to be heard. Reach out to friends and family and have those hard conversations. And please don't beat yourself up if you ever use a plastic straw.
So kind of on your last point there, just coming out of the holidays, it can be really tough to talk to family members, especially family members whose political views don't align with your own, about these issues. So what advice do you have to people who, you know, may go home to families who are, you know, climate change deniers, and how do you start those conversations, and how do you approach it in a way that, you know, might actually be kind of successful in convincing them that this is a real issue?
That's a tough one. I mean, I know I have a lot of friends who have gone over the holidays and had pretty much this experience, and a lot of times it's ended in kind of a bit of conflict. But, yeah, I mean, do what you can. You know your family. You know what kind of stuff they'll be receptive to. But, don't let them tell you climate change isn't real, because we know it is. But, I don't know if Kate has any suggestions for that.
I mean, yeah, I guess protect yourself. I'm such a big advocate of drawing boundaries within your own family and with folks who have shitty politics. But also, I think there is space for us to meet people where they're at, and figure out how we can find those spaces of alignment. I have friends whose parents are involved in the fossil fuel industry, who have been really badly hurt by corporations, who have no incentive to stick around and protect their workers, who make a quick buck and then leave, and create ghost towns in their wake. And people in the fossil fuel industry have been taught that their suffering is a consequence of environmentalists on the West Coast who are trying to stop pipelines, and not the corporations that are leaving them behind. And so trying to get at the things that people are worried about, like, most of us are worried about the same things. It's being able to have our basic needs met and have a community that is sustainable. And wherever we can, finding those places of alignment, and then naming the real enemy when it comes to who is keeping us from having these things.
Yeah, absolutely. One of my last questions is, how do you stay hopeful? Because I know for me, when thinking about a lot of these issues, especially because it's discussed in so many of my classes, and especially being a forestry student, you know, my future career, like, absolutely, everybody's future relies on you know, the climate staying stable. But I can find it to be really depressing. So how do you keep your hope through all of this, especially when you're so involved in it?
Rebecca Solnit has this quote that I'm not going to get it right, but it's something along the lines of, hope is the axe that you use to break down the door when the house is burning. And I love that, because this is a moment where there is a lot of grief that is being felt and that sometimes needs to be felt. But all is not lost, and there is space for us to be challenging the way that things are. Like, nothing is certain. Movements do work. And this is when we need people to be feeling their grief and then using their hope to fuel action. So that's personally how I stay hopeful.
Yeah, climate grief is very much a real thing. And it's really just important for everyone to, like, take some space, acknowledge that, hold that grief, feel it. And then if you can, like, use that to fuel a movement, fuel talking to people about it. Something we've had in the past, and that we have sometimes, we've had, like, talked about climate grief in meetings and stuff, and we've brought it up as a topic. And, yeah, it's really important to talk about, because it's very real. I feel sad about stuff because of climate change all the time. And it's important to give yourself some space for that and see how you can use that to make some change.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're almost out of time, but I guess my last question is, you talked a lot about people educating themselves on these issues. Do you have any resources that you would recommend? Because there's so much out there from so many different perspectives, especially like, you know, in the light of like, kind of, you know, fake news and so many, you know, climate deniers posting, you know, articles and stuff that are just kind of completely incorrect. It can be really hard to find, you know, credible sources. But do you have like either people to follow or documentaries to watch or books to read? Or yeah, where do you go to educate yourselves?
I feel like we both have plenty. I would follow Harsha Walia, who is an anti-border and migrant justice activist. I would follow the Migrant Rights Network, which is a Canadian network organizing for migrant justice. I would follow Climate Justice Toronto, which has some really good takes on all the issues that are linked to climate change. I would follow Indigenous Climate Action. There's a whole, if you dive into Indigenous Twitter, you'll find lots of cool people who are saying really important things about work that's going on right now. I would follow Una Stotenkamp on social media, Conhus Manuel, who's a Sequekmek warrior with the Tiny House Warriors, resisting mining and pipelines on their territories. Max?
You named most of the ones I was going to say, but for TMX also, there's a group called Mountain Protectors that is in the Watch House by the Westbridge Terminal. They're on Facebook. I would go on Instagram and Twitter, follow those Indigenous Land Defenders. That's where I find most of the good shit is originating. But if you're looking for like I would say just most of the time, it's best to go straight from the source. Like if you want to learn about Una Stotenkamp, they have a lot of information on their website. Like if you want to learn about Tiny House Warriors, like go follow Canu's Manuel's Instagram and whatever. That's how I find, you'll probably find the best information.
Awesome. Those all sound like really great resources. I myself will go follow probably most of them right after this. But thank you so much for coming. It was such a pleasure to have you guys back in the studio.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, so follow them on social media, follow their campaigns, go to their meetings. They're doing some really important work, and it would be a really great opportunity for any of you to be involved. So again, thank you so much. This was UBC C350 on 24 Hours of Student Power on CITR 101.9 FM.
Control to Major Tom. You are listening to CITR 101.9 broadcasting the odd from Vancouver, British Columbia.
Of conquest with time, but I remember leaning. song.